You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 16.
Altitude.
Tower 26 is released to you, runway 411, 0 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector. Loves me, I'm ready to play. My program curveballs at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
Viper 1 targeted.
I had already made up a plan before we took off to go to this private airstrip and drop them off at the closest safe place as possible. But then we realized that I'm like, hey, so what are the injuries like? And the flight engineers were telling me, dude, there's some bad ones back here. We've got about, you know, 24 people that have some sort of injury. Some of these are pretty major burns, like second, third degree burns over 40% of your body or more. There's some people with broken bones. One guy literally was crawling up to the aircraft because he had broken both of his ankles.
That's the voice of my guest today, Chief Warrant Officer 5, Joseph Rosamond. He's a Chinook helicopter pilot and Army National Guardsman out in California. And he's describing the events of September 5th, where he and his crew, alongside a Black Hawk crew, are credited with rescuing over 240 individuals who were stranded during these wildfires, many of which had severe injuries. It is quite an incredible story. For their efforts, each crew member was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for their heroism by the president just a few weeks ago. We're going to dig deep into this story. It's quite incredible in my opinion. I've broken it into two parts, both of which are available right now for you to download and listen. Before we get rolling, just a few admin notes. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Hangar 24 Craft Brewing. They have three tap rooms, Redlands, California, Orange County, and then Lake Havasu, Arizona. If you're in the region, I highly encourage you to swing by. This is a beer aviation adventure company. Absolutely love their beer. I love the brand. I love the people. If you live in California, Arizona, you can actually have their beer shipped to you, or you can find it at a store near you. Hangar24craftbrewing.com. You can use their beer locator to find it near you. I'd also like to thank Squadron Posters, again, a company that I just absolutely love, and I've been a customer of theirs for several years. They have upped the game from just making posters to share the adventure and your journey through life. I would encourage you to swing by squadronposters.com and check out their bomber style artwork. It's a really cool way to display, again, your journey. And also, they have metal nose art. So if you want something that looked like it just came off the side of a plane with whatever graphic design you want on there, they can do that. Swing over to squadronposters.com and orders over $59 or more receive a 10% discount with the discount code RAIN10. That's RAIN10. I'd also like to thank Wingman Watches for sponsoring this podcast. Again, another company that I just absolutely love, and I love their products. If you're looking to build a custom watch, this is their bread and butter. You can work with their design team to commemorate your journey, your organization, your unit, whatever it might be, through a custom watch that's affordable and is high quality. Swing by wingmanwatch.com and you can use the code RAIN10 to receive a discount on any current watch that's on there, or you can mention my name to receive a discount on your group customization order. With the admin out of the way, let's get into the podcast with Chief Warrant Officer Joe Rosamond. So if you go ahead and say something real quick.
All right. Testing the audio here.
Yeah, that's perfect. So Joe, thanks for joining me today. I'm excited to have you on the podcast. I'm branching out into the Army. So C25 Rosamond, thank you for joining me on the podcast today. Happy to have you here and excited to hear about your story.
Yep, having me.
Will you tell me a little about who you are, like the brief snapshot of how you got to where you are today in life and what you're doing?
Yeah, you know, it's really a right time, right place kind of story. I happened to be the only guy at the sitting there at the boards for flight school when I actually applied. So I grew up as in California, and I had some roots here already. I was actually going to join the Air Force, called the recruiter out of high school. They never called me back. Apparently they didn't like my senior grades, but, so the Army recruiter called me back, you know, and I'm like, hey, I want to go fly. I've
always wanted to go fly, you know, and goes, well, you know, I can't get you into flight school, but we can get you near the people that can affect that. Right. And so ended up taking an MOS that put me in ops, you know, and immediately started working on that flight packet and got it done pretty quickly. And they had a shortfall course for me. So I went to the board. They were like, can you leave in a week and a half? I'm like, yeah, I'm single. I have nothing to do. Yeah. I'll leave in a week and a half.
Done. You know? Yeah. No joke. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, I grew up, I was a Boy Scout. I'd always had my parents that were, pushing me to do things and make goals and make these smaller goals to reach bigger ones, you know, and that was one of the steps, to accomplish what I wanted, you know, what I wanted to do.
And now you're a California Guardsman flying CH-47s, yep, the Chinook. Have you been doing that your entire career?
Yeah. So, right out of flight school, I got the Chinook transition. I've been flying Chinooks the whole time. I did get qualified in the Lakota a few years back when I was a battalion level dude. Never really progressed in it though. They keep asking me, but I, at the time I was also doing ratings, catching up on all that. So flying around that Cessna, that real fast Cessna, you know.
Yeah, just screaming.
Yeah, because, you know, like everybody else pre-COVID, you know, we were all looking at the airlines, you know.
Yep.
I was looking at the two, and that was my primary plan. In fact, I was supposed to be in training right now, but COVID kind of messed all that up. And so I got all my fixed wing stuff done. And at the same time, they wanted me to progress in the Lakota. I'm like, nah, learning that on top of what I'm already doing for myself is a little much. So I kind of postponed that a bit. But yeah, my whole career I'm working on my 23rd year now. And it's all been, all but two of it's been Chinooks.
So. That's incredible. 23 years of flying. So we're kind of joking before we hit the record button here. Like, I had one sortie in Lakota, down at Fort Polk, the guys who took me flying, I think much like yourselves, all warrant officers, very seasoned guys who've been flying for the Army for a long time. They weren't huge fans of the Lakota, especially because they've been flying the Black Hawk. And I guess it underpowered, couldn't carry as much, but drastic difference between the Lakota and the Chinook, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing. At our facility here in Stockton, we have both. I mean, we run both the Lakota and the Chinook. And so, yeah, they're two totally different airframes, too. You know, the sizes are just so much different, you know, and learning how to operate both of those here on the same flight line. That was a challenge enough. But luckily, like, we had some roots back. We had Hueys and Cobras and Chinooks here for quite a while, you know. So we kind of already had some stuff set up. We had kind of our infrastructure already kind of set up to have our skid side and our hook side of the flight line and all that. So it's worked out well. We were all very, I guess all the Chinook guys, when they said, oh, you're going to have the Lakotas there at your facility, we're kind of like, are you sure about that? What about this guy? You
know? Yeah. It's, I mean, vastly different worlds. I'm sure, you know, it's the same and anywhere you go, right? Like, there's always pilots competing against pilots, but
yeah.
For flying the Chinook versus the Lakota and the Guard, especially a California Guard, what does a day in the life of a Chinook pilot look like versus the day in the life of a Lakota pilot?
So there actually is quite a bit of difference there. The Chinook guys typically, I mean, one, California, I think, has one of the best training areas, especially for helicopters and what we do in general. I mean, we've got the mountains that go all the way up to, you know, 10,000-12,000 feet in our training area. We've got, and in the other direction, we've got the coastal stuff, and Southern California, we've got desert, you know, we've got every topographic type of area in California that we can go train at, which is great. And so the Chinook guys will typically, we'll go out to the east, to the Sierras, and because of the quality of that training area, it's really nice that we can go out and do what we think is just normal. We're going to go out and pick up a sling load. We're going to go do some slope landings, do some terrain flight. And we just think it's normal, but it really is pretty spectacular in the amount of training you get. And I really saw that come to light when we had our first deployment in 2003. That was right after the kickoff of the war, you know, And the unit had not been deployed since like Vietnam, you know, and all these Vietnam dudes were jumping ship because they'd already done their tours, right? And so, and you, we realized pretty quickly how our training area really helped us prepare and get ready for what we were going to see overseas. And then once again, in 08, when we did our Afghan deployment, we were already comfortable in the mountains, whereas some, a lot of other units weren't, you know, and the Chinook's kind of made for the mountains, and we knew how to operate it in the, in those, in that environment. So it made it really, really easy to do that. And so that, having that ability to just change, like, oh, we're going to go to the desert. Well, let's go to the desert training area and we'll go do some dust landings out there. It really helped out. And being that we all just felt it was normal, that's what we do every week. We go out to the mountains, do some terrain flight, pick up a cement block or two, you know, and do it under goggles, you know, and it's beautiful training area. You know, you get halfway done, stop at Tahoe for dinner and then goggle up, come back type of thing. And it's just, it's really awesome to be able to do all that, you know. And we have we've got some Class Bs near us, some Class Charlies that are near us, you know, and you can really get this, I guess this broadening of your skills as a pilot. You're not just stuck on a range going around the post, you know, every single day. We can branch out and do a bunch of different things. And the Lakota guys, they get to do the same stuff. They don't do sling loads as much as we do. I mean, they're not made for that, and they just have a different mission. But they'll go do, they'll link up with some law enforcement guys. We have a pretty robust counter drug program, and the Lakotas go out and do counter drug reconnaissance, and they'll, the ground guys will set up some nets, and they'll do a lot of reclamation of grow sites and whatnot. And then they also have like the law enforcement type of thing. We've got the Night Sun, some FLIR on them, and they'll go out and support local agencies and that sort of thing. And really unique on this last fire that we're on, they got these LRAD, like large, huge speakers, and they stuck them inside the cabin of the Lakota. And they were just, those speakers they're really used for like crowd control.
Yeah.
Like, turn them up really loud and like make it a really annoying sound. And do some like riot control stuff, but we used them to get like evacuation orders out on the John Muir Trail. And so they were flying up and down the John Muir Trail just saying, hey, evacuate now. And they were able to cover a lot of ground doing that, which is really, really unique for them.
Yeah, it's kind of wild to see all the different platforms and what they bring to the fight, right? And it's different, right? Whether you're in combat or if you're fighting fires, whatever it might be. But I'm just kind of curious, as being a fixed wing guy, the very basic stuff. So Chinook, like, versus Lakota, like, okay. I've seen these like gnarly photos of a Chinook with like the tail end down on this hut on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan, just unloading a bunch of dudes like onto the rooftop of this mud hut.
Yeah.
And I know
is it?
Yeah. So like, I know there's like density altitude. There's a lot of like skill that goes into doing it. But when it comes to like lifting stuff, if we go like at sea level, what's the difference between those two platforms and a Black Hawk? And then what is some of the challenges of flying in high altitude environments?
Yeah. So, okay. I think the basic difference between the Chinook and any of those other helicopters, right? We're talking our traditional helicopters that have a main rotor and a tail rotor, right? The Chinook doesn't have a tail rotor. It's got the two main rotors. They counter rotate, which sets the torque. But what's really unique about it is that now all of that lift that's being generated by those two rotor discs are going purely for lift, just to lift things up, right? Whereas in your traditional helicopters, Lakotas, Blackhawks, it gets a little bit more complicated, but they have that anti-torque rotor on the tail, and some of that horsepower gets used to keep it from spinning in place, right? And that's one of the main differences. And so, of course, capacities are going to be different. Since the Chinooks are a cargo platform, they carry a lot of cargo, which means a lot of pounds of whatever, whether that's people, beans, bullets, whatever. Right? Yep. I always make a comparison when we do our Cal Fire training every year. We do a capabilities brief because we have a lot of new firefighters coming in, and they don't know the capabilities either, right? And so, I always kind of set up the Blackhawk guys a little bit because I'll let them brief first, and then you know, they'll say, oh yeah, you're 11 passengers, you know, whatever the pounds of cargo is. I think it might be 6,000 pounds of cargo, something like that, right? I'm not a Blackhawk guy, so I don't know. And they talk about their fuel burn or whatever. And I just walk up after and say, everything they said, multiply it by three. That's what we can do, right?
and mic drop.
Yeah, and that's also what we cost. I mean, both in the positive and the negative, we cost three times more. We use three times as much fuel, but we can move three times as much stuff at one time, you know. And generally, it's kind of weird. It works out.
Yeah, which how we stumbled across each other. September 5th, you were pretty busy working.
Yeah.
And it comes down, I don't know, being able to make one trip into the hot zone and get a bunch of people out or into, depending on what your mission set is a big deal. So when it comes to flying the Chinook, obviously you're a bigger target. There are other things to consider. But on that night of September 5th, you were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross along with all of your crew, as well as the crew of the Blackhawk crew for rescuing over 240 people. So really busy night going in there. And I really want to dig down into the sortie and that night in particular. Can you kind of talk to like the lead up of what was happening in the days prior to that or the day of that mission?
Yeah. So we, the entire state of California, the Army Guard and really the Air Guard as well, we were all responding to wildfires. And most of us, most of the guys were responding to the wildfires up north that were caused by the lightning strikes. We had this rogue, like dry lightning storm come through and it just sparked off hundreds of fires. And so they were, a lot of the guys were responding to that. Well, at the same time, like my unit, the brigade headquarters, we were on our annual training, getting ready for our mobilization that's coming up, right? And so there was a lot of us that were kind of out of the fight because we were doing that training instead of actual operational stuff. So the flight companies, they took over the brunt of the work. They had all the crews out. I mean, I think we surged to like five or six aircraft at one time from just our Chinook facility. And that's not including the 7 to 10 Blackhawks that were out on the fires. And I mean, just this massive response to all these fires going on. And they were out there for a couple weeks prior to September 5th. So they finally got kind of control of those fires and they started releasing assets. Cal Fire started releasing assets. And I want to say just about everybody was back at home station. They had just gotten done like the Tuesday before this mission on the 5th. And everybody was finally resetting. Actually, I want to say, I remember I had trained up, we had an out-of-state group. We had an Illinois group come in. And I trained them up on the Monday and Tuesday prior to the 5th. And by Thursday, everybody was done. Everybody was released. And Cal Fire really released everybody. So everybody's resetting back at home station and getting ready for the long weekend, right? It was Labor Day weekend. And so Saturday comes around and it was late in the afternoon. It was probably like 4:30 in the afternoon. And we get this mass text from our flight scheduler. It's like, hey, looking for a crew to do a rescue. We know it's going to be Mammoth. We think it's going to be Mammoth Pools, about 30 people. So I get the text. It's kind of getting ready for the weekend, but I'm like, hey, honey, you know, all the other guys have been out busting their butts on fires. I feel like it's my turn to volunteer for this. And she's been doing this for just as many years as me, right? I mean, she's been an Army wife for 23 years, right? So she's like, yeah, whatever you feel like, whatever you need to do. And so I just responded to the text. Hey, I'm in, like, I'm available. And I live really close to the facility. So my response time is half an hour versus some other guys that may be 2.5 hours, right? So it just makes sense that when I'm available, I can usually do this. And most of the time our rescues are like one day missions, right? So go out, do whatever we need to do, come back home. And this time when I was getting ready, I asked my wife, like, hey, you know, can you get me my water bottle all set up, get some ice in there, whatnot. And I'm going to pack an overnight bag just in case. It's already late in the afternoon. We might have to remain overnight once we get this done, but I'll just bring a one day bag. And luckily I actually packed for 3 days, but cause it ended up being 8 days that we were out there.
Were you operating in and out of your base, or was it like a forward operating base?
No, so we had moved. So we so that afternoon around 6:30 or so, we launched and we were heading down to the Fresno area. We ended up RONing. We ended up RONing in Fresno, our Army guard unit, their facility down in Fresno.
Okay.
Yeah, so we were out of our own home station, and but we went. So we, like I said, we launched about 6:30 at night. It was about an hour flight, hour and 10 minutes to get down to the location. And we'd gotten the word, hey, just, there was a lot of talk about, okay, are we going to go to Fresno and stage, or are we going to go directly to the incident? And the decision finally came that we're going to go directly to the incident. And this is right as we're getting ready to take off. So I get the text, even though I'm not supposed to be using my phone in the aircraft, right? We call it MFD 6.
Right. Yeah.
We've got five MFDs in the, but that's like the SATCOM, that's the everything, right?
That's gonna give you the most information.
Yeah, totally, right? So pull it out, okay, direct to the incident. So off we go, direct to Mammoth Pools. But we took off not knowing a lot. Like, we knew that there was a fire there because these people were being rescued because of the fire, right? So, and it also kind of, we got more information. Now it was 30 families, not just 30 people. So instead of one trip, now we know it's gonna be multiple trips.
Right. Yeah. That changes it for sure.
Yeah. Had no idea that the Black Hawk was coming at this time. So we're doing some mental math in our head. We're like, okay, 120 ish people. It's going to be four trips. Yeah. This is going to be a long night. So we were kind of prepared for that, but we didn't know any of the frequencies for the fire, for the TFR or the fire traffic area. So, but luckily our training that we did with Cal Fire, I've done about 15 fire seasons in my career, so I'm pretty familiar with what we need to know. And so I already knew what we didn't know, right? So, which is, when you're going into something and you just don't know what you don't know, that's probably the most dangerous, right? But yep. At least we knew what holes we needed to fill. And so just got on the radio with the North Ops, or the Sacramento Emergency Communication Center for Cal Fire. And started asking them, hey, I needed the information for the Creek Fire. And we're 45 minutes out, right? And and they were great. They gave us a bunch of frequencies and was able to get a hold of the air attack, or the aerial supervisor for the fire, while we were en route.
So do they, I'm used to combat, right? Like a JTAC owns like a ROS or something like that you're checking in with. Operating these stateside TFRs, they'll pop up that way, it's restricted, but who is owning that fight, if you will? Is it Cal Fire, and is there a director that's managing all the air assets are moving in and out of, and people that are moving in and out? Who owns that?
Yeah, so the incident has the incident commander, and he owns everything, right? He's over both the ground and the air kind of assets, but he's got people working for him, and that could be U.S. Forest Service, it could be the state. So for us, it's Cal Fire, right? Or it could be a local guy. And as the incident grows, it'll grow to a larger incident command team. And that team consists of all your ground operations, like your branch chiefs and that sort of thing. But then there's also the air operations branch director, the AOBD, we call it. And that dude, he controls the air fight. He puts in an aerial supervisor, an ASM, usually like a Bronco or like OV-10 or somebody in a fixed wing airplane above the entire incident. And he's controlling what we call the fire traffic area, or the FTA. And we call his call sign is usually like the incident name. Like, this was the Creek Fire, be the Creek Air Attack.
Gotcha.
And so he's the guy who's controlling the in and out, clearing people in. And when they get a lot, and his basic job is one to control the air fight, but now the air fight turns into both fixed wing, we're talking tankers, map.
He can see from above the fire, he can see like where it's running to, the big macro picture. And so he can make kind of priorities on where they're gonna drop tankers. So his main role is to drop tankers. We're talking like global super tankers, C-130s, the Air Guard C-130s with their mass stuff on it. And usually like a few helicopters. Now when they start ordering more assets and they get a lot of helicopters and they have a lot of tankers, that becomes a little bit too much for one guy to handle. So they'll call in for what's called a helicopter coordinator, or a HELCO is what we call them. And so it's a dude in a little helicopter, a little Type 3 helicopter, like a Jet Ranger or something, or a Lakota. Our Lakotas do that mission a lot. And they have the same sort of aerial supervisor qualified guy that's on board, and he's just getting direction from the air attack and will prioritize where the helicopters go. And so now the air attack only has to call one guy to say, hey, I'm going to be dropping tankers in, you know, division whatever, so hold the helicopters. And so all the helicopters will hold like at a dip site somewhere. Tankers will come in, drop, they'll get do their exit, and then okay, after this next tanker's in, the helicopters are cleared back in to start doing bucket work again. So then the helco will tell us that, and we'll get going again. So there's this whole traffic area, kind of like an airport traffic area, I'm going to call it a fire traffic area, sitting around any fire. So and it starts with a 12-mile ring, and that's where we first need to start calling air attack, trying to get our clearance in. And hopefully we get our clearance right away. If we don't, then you don't get any closer than 7 miles. At 7 miles, you hold. And that way, it gives him time to do whatever he's doing and then get back to you. And it keeps you out of that traffic area, so you're not becoming a hazard, or you're not unexpected by somebody else who's going from, you know, a dip site to where he's working on the fire. He's just going back and forth all day long. And next thing you know, there's this other aircraft that he wasn't expecting in there. Right? So it's just all about that control.
Yeah, different world. You know, again, I'm used to flying overseas, like if it's in a combat zone, right? And I'm not really worried about helicopters unless it's a show of force, yeah. Right? Like you're deconflicted. But watching some of those tankers drop in, like those tankers are low and you're talking about a DC-10, like it is going to be a conflict. When it comes down to even like driving to the fire zone, I assume you guys are using ForeFlight or some kind of moving map that is updating with real-time TFRs. Are those TFRs pretty accurate? Is that like where you're getting your data from, like the most real-time data as far as what the fire zone looked like?
Yeah. So we have ForeFlight on our iPads and whatnot, and we have a Stratus on board, so we can have the real-time data for both traffic, because there's times you're not going to have cell coverage on the iPad, right? So, yep. We use the Stratus in order to get the ADS-B, you know, in and the TFR and weather information and that sort of thing. And so that comes in really handy. We can kind of see where people are coming in at, especially now that the ADS-B is mandated, you know. So that comes in really, really handy. In this particular night, there was no TFR established yet, because it takes a little time. So this thing grew so fast that they hadn't established the TFR yet. So it really just came down to this training that we do every year and just knowing, okay, I can't get any closer than 7 miles. Otherwise I'll be in somebody's way. And there's nothing regulatory about it, right? It's not like it's controlled airspace. It's a GA guy could go, oh, hey, look, fire. I'm going to go over there and check it out, because my house is over by Shaver Lake or whatever, right? And he can go blasting through there, and it'll shut down the entire firefight, the aerial firefight, because there's somebody busting the FTA. So that's what, like every year Cal Fire puts out, hey, don't fly your drones, don't go towards wildfires, just stay away, you know, and we can continue fighting.
It's kind of like, I mean, a MOA, right? Like I've stopped fights because guys have come blitzing through their VFR, which is completely legal to do.
Yeah.
If it's not a TFR, a temporary flight restriction, like, Sounds like it's it's legal, right? Like an FTA is not necessarily a regulatory thing, as you mentioned. So that's wild. But I can completely see people want to go. It's like the rubberneckers, right?
They just
want to go
moths to flames.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah,
literally moths to flames.
Yeah.
So on that night, you guys repositioning down to Fresno, but en route you guys vector over to the Creek Fire.
Yeah. So right as we're getting ready to take off, we get the word go direct to the incident. So we got all the information we needed. We got a hold of the air attack that was above the fire still, because it was still daylight. They fly until night. They don't do night ops. So it was getting close to sunset when we got there. Called him up. He cleared us in right away. And then I tried to verify the grid coordinate, right? Like, or the lat long. And so through some of the fog of war, some of the confusion going on there, I get a grid coordinate, and of course it's not in the right format. It doesn't work in the FMS, right? And so, all right, man, go through. Luckily we have a conversion thing on the iPad. So, you know, I'm converting, you know, lat longs and plugging them into the FMS, and pop, and the little icon will pop up on my moving map, and that's nowhere near Mammoth Pools, you know. So, and so I had about seven different lat longs that I had all labeled in there as, you know, potential LZ1, potential LZ2, you know, and they were, none of them were near each other. None of them were near where I thought we were going. So it just added a little bit more confusion. And during that, we had decided that we're just going to kind of circle right here by the fire, in this area that we're kind of out of the way. They're dropping tankers. We're not in the way of the helicopters, not in the way of the fixed wing guys. And we're just going to kind of have a tactical pause here and try to figure out where exactly we need to go. And we kind of had this idea in the back of our minds, well, we're supposed to be going to Mammoth Pools, but we need somebody to kind of clear us in there. So I'm trying to use their lingo, right, and use some of the terrain features on the map to kind of explain to this air attack, hey, this is where I want to go. This is where I am, and this is where I want to go. Am I clear to do that, right? Can I do that without getting in the way of somebody else? And that took a little bit of conversation. And about that same time, the Blackhawk showed up. And I didn't know the Blackhawk was coming until they called in.
Is that from your sister squadron, or is that another unit?
Yeah, that was another unit. Out, well, it's still California Guard, still under the 40th Cab, just the guys out of Fresno that are based out.
Okay.
And I heard them call in, so we switched over to their frequency, their internal frequency, and started talking to them. But they kind of got held out because what ended up happening is the air attack that was on scene, he got to bingo fuel, right? So he was running out of fuel. The next air attack shows up on scene. They're doing a handoff, like a battle handover for the fire. They've got this big, long briefing that they have to do. And now he's got us calling in, and he's got this Blackhawk calling in. It was probably a little overwhelming, I would imagine. And yeah. So he holds the Blackhawk out. Said, no, you're not cleared in. Stay outside of the fire traffic area for now. And while he figures out what I need. So I'm asking him a bunch of questions. And I'm sure he didn't have the information. He's just trying to do the best he can, you know. And eventually what ends up happening is all the tankers finish dropping. All the helicopters leave because it's nighttime. And everybody's at cutoff. They call it cutoff, like half hour after sunset. And he's like, hey, guys, I'm out. Like, the show's all yours. You're the only ones out here. And good luck. Here's a frequency to call the incident commander down on the ground. And see you guys in the morning.
So, wow.
Yeah. And that was like the best thing that could have happened, I think, at the because now it's like, all right, we own the airspace. We're the only ones out here. I don't have to worry about going inadvertent IMC into a smoke cloud, climbing up into a tanker, climbing up into somebody. So that really took a lot of the risk and mitigated it, you know, like real quickly. Now, so it's just me and the Blackhawk. And now we're in the same unit, right? And so we have standardized processes that we were working. And about that time is when, you know, we were right in the transition period, not quite EENT, you know, not quite dark enough for goggles, not quite bright enough for your naked eye. And so I'm flipping the goggles back and forth and finally get to a point where I'm like, hey guys, it's a whole lot better with goggles on right now. So let's all transition to goggles.
And that's the worst part.
Oh yeah.
Of like either nighttime or daytime. It's that transition. That's like the most dangerous part. Yep. Flying around is because the night vision doesn't really work.
Yeah.
Your eyes don't really work. And then I can't even imagine operating in that environment. I've seen the videos and post them on social media again, like everything is on fire. It's just burning and smoke. So that's an incredibly hazardous spot to be flying around.
Yeah. So we had found this like little clear zone that was kind of clear of the smoke outside of the active fire. We're kind of circling this apple orchard for a while. And we're like, okay, well, we need to come up with a plan. Cause we verified with the guy on the ground, the ops people on the ground with the incident commander. We're like, hey, just tell us where these people are. Like, are they at Mammoth Pools or are they somewhere else? And he confirmed Mammoth Pools for us. So we knew right away, all right, I already have that in the GPS. Let's go. We need to come up with a plan to go and get these people. We had found a portion. So like the really active fire has a lot of smoke billowing up from that. And it's like a wall of smoke, right? So We find this spot in the fire way down in the drainage, San Joaquin River drainage, where there's like a break in it as it crossed the river. Water's not on fire. So there's this break where the river is of this active, really active fire and where the smoke is. They're like, hey, you know, how about we try to go through right there and we'll see what's on the other side? Because at this point, we don't really know what's on the other side as far as conditions are, because all you see is the wall, right? Everybody agreed. The entire crew was like, yep, I'm on board with that. You know, we still had some outs, right? We could turn around, we could climb up. We didn't have to worry about traffic, like I said. So we just go for that hole in the smoke wall. And once we got through it and to the other side, we realized it's dark. It's really dark and it's really smoky, you know, and almost immediately we're like, how the hell are we going to see the terrain? Cause now the terrain's black cause it's burned. It's dark. And pretty quickly after that initial, like, oh my God, kind of moment, we started making out like, oh, hey, look, like all these trees are still on fire. All these bushes, all this vegetation is still on fire. And you can see some of the videos out there and some of the pictures that have been posted around where it looks like just stars, you know, stars on the night sky. But they were fires illuminating this terrain. And that's really how we were able to see the terrain. It was so dark that it was, you know, hand in front of your face, not seeing anything dark, but these little spot fires were kind of outlining the contours for us.
Yeah, Joe, that's one thing that I guess I saw that video, and for people that are listening, they can go look at this. That perspective right there to me, like, is mind boggling, because when I saw that video, I'm like, oh, everything is on fire. Obviously it's a bad spot, but I've been flying around at night, like over water where you can't tell if it's a boat or if it's stars. Hearing, like, for you to say the only way we could find out it was terrain is because it was burning, right? All those little fires, like, again, for those listening, like, it's an incredibly hazardous spot to be flying around, like, much more so than, you know, most things other than getting shot at. Like, that's it's right below that one, I would say.
Yeah, and I've said it a couple times where, like, this was probably the most dangerous spot that we intentionally put ourselves into in my entire career. Of course, when we were talking about, like, combat stuff and we're talking about getting shot at, that's somebody else making a decision. You know, they have a choice in that fight, and you don't really have that choice. It just happens, right? And you have to react to it. But this was definitely the worst intentional place that we kind of put ourselves into. But each one of the crew, we felt that the reward was worth that risk.
And you're operating purely based upon grids, which I will say too, it is phenomenal to me that in 2020 that we have issues with grids. I ran into it in my last deployment with minutes, decimal minutes, which, as I found out, because going to go drop bombs, the guy was going to take the grids we were given and put them in the jet, which was minutes, decimal seconds, and put them in the jet, which is minutes, decimal minutes, and would have ended poorly. And after this whole rabbit trail, come to find out that no U.S. fighter uses minutes, decimal seconds like we're given the grids in from the strike planners. It's only for the TLAM. So it's attention to detail and minor things like that that obviously make a big difference. Yeah. But you guys, you've converted those, and now you're operating purely based off probably somewhat old data you've had to convert in order to fly into, you know, the devil's den to go find these people. Yeah. So how did you, I mean, was it those grids that took you right to the first people you had to go to, or what was it?
All those grids we were given, they were bad. Like, and over the years, you know, you learn, like, all right, I've been burned on a bad grid before. And luckily for me, it just means landing in the wrong spot. It doesn't mean I blew up the wrong town, right? Or whatever, you know, the wrong target, right? Yeah. So I've been burned on that before. And so every time I get a grid and you can tell when they say it a certain way, like if they say like 32 dot, you know, seven, and it gives you this like eight digits after the decimal, you know, okay, that's degrees, decimal degrees. Right. And if you get this other weird one, like I always ask, all right, what is that, degrees, minutes, seconds, or is that degrees, minutes, tenths of minutes? Right. And usually that blows their mind. They're like, what? Like, they don't know what they're talking about. But, and so pretty quickly you can figure that out. And, so all those grids were bad. They were all right there at the edge of the fire, like basically where I was at, within like 5 miles. And I'm like, none of those are right. None of them are near a lake. They're, you know, they, I don't know where these grids came from. So what ended up happening, once I called the air ops guy, or I'm sorry, the operations branch chief, I was like, just tell me, are they at Mammoth Pools? Like, yep, they're at Mammoth Pools. I said, cool. I can see Mammoth Pools on a map. I put my cursor over there, dropped a coordinate right on Mammoth Pools. I didn't have to look at the coordinates. You know, it was just, you know, pointy talky type of stuff and go direct there. And so that's how that worked out. And so once we got to the lake, after going through this canyon of fire, right? Once we got to the lake, then it became kind of like, okay, now where on the lake are these people? It's not like we had a 10-digit grid or a really good lat long. It was, we were going to the center point of the lake. But once we got there, they heard us and they started flashing all their lights on their vehicles that were down there, which helped out. You know, yeah. We would have been going the wrong way because I was in the right seat. So my initial reaction, once we hit the spillway, was to turn right and just start following and looking at the beach line. But they were over at my 10 o'clock and my co-pilot, he was one, hey, I see flashlights over there. Perfect. Let's turn that way. And it ended up being them.
You know, it's such a basic principle. And I would say probably in the helicopter world, you maintain it. Flying fixed wing, I think it gets lost really quick with all the technology, but it comes to like looking out the window and something is basic like, where are they? They're at the Mammoth Lake. Like you either can look out the window and see it. You can see it on a sectional and go there. Like it's something pure and simple, but not just purely relying on the technology. And then again, hats off to those people. I mean, it probably comes down to survival, right? Like you're surrounded by fire. You're going to do whatever you can to get people to look at you.
If I've been sitting there, just got burned over, we have, you know, there's people in this group that are burned or have broken bones or whatever. And, you know, and we're sitting there for hours and it's quiet, right? There's nothing going on besides this fire crackling in the background. And then I start hearing like helicopters, like, or any real like aircraft, you know, aircraft noise coming over. I think a reaction would be, hey, we need to signal these guys. The visibility is, it's dark for them. So it's even worse for them. Right. And we need to, I would think a signal, like, there's got to be one person there who's like a Boy Scout who did something in their life where they know, okay, we need to get a signal out, right? And that's exactly what they do.
Right. So going in there, obviously you find them. And now the next step, I would imagine, is finding a good LZ. Yeah. There's probably a lot of threats. I know you do it day in and day out. Again, it's probably like putting on your pants to go to work. But for most of us, I mean, you're going in there at night. I know you do have MVGs, but there's smoke. Like, you don't know if there's power lines and all these other threats. So was that the next step, finding a good LZ, and what did you have to do?
It was kind of difficult, but it happened really quick. And you bring up the power lines. That was, we did see some power lines that crossed the valley we were flying down on the sectional. And so, you know, the ones that show up on the sectional are the big ones, right? And so that for a moment was actually a really scary moment because we realized that on the black background, we wouldn't be able to see the lines or the poles. There's zero contrast, right? So they were basically invisible. But we did see the powerhouse down the river that they went to. So that became the pole, right? We always, in helicopter world, you know, wires are a thing, right? And so we always cross at a pole because you know that if you cross over the pole of a wire, there's not going to be anything above it. Yeah. If you try to cross between the poles, you know, you could see the sag of the main power lines, but you may not see the tension line that runs straight across, right? So there's nothing taller than, there's not going to be anything sticking out above the poles. So we cross at the poles. Well, that power plant ended up, we knew that these lines are running down to the valley floor to this power plant. And so we knew that's basically our pole. So we flew as high as we could, with, you know, the smoke above us over that power plant. And then once we didn't hit them on the other side, we were like, okay, we're clear, you know? So
problems I've never had.
So we got through that. And once we got to the LZ, well, then, you know, we get to the dam and I'm thinking, well, you know, a lot of dams are used as power as well, but, some of the cues for that kind of weren't there. We, We didn't see lights. We didn't see buildings. We didn't see, even on the sectional, there was no like power lines going to the dam area where this hydroelectric plant might be. So so we kind of determined that there's probably, if there are wires, they're the smaller like telephone pole road wires, and we're not that low right now, you know? And so that risk kind of was mitigated, I thought.
But then comes into like finding a good spot to land, right? I mean, not familiar with that area, but I imagine there's not a whole lot of like flat open spots.
Yeah,
I mean,
these are basically bowls in the mountains that just collect water, right? So nothing's flat. Tree, anywhere that would be flat is full of trees. It was a campsite and whatnot. But and the water level, I can almost immediately tell that the water, we're in a drought, the water level's down. And so you can see like the tree line and where the water line was a good 40 feet. And it was extremely steep there. And so we basically kind of come to a hover, really slow, maybe like 20 knots, kind of hover around and kind of see the group of people, see where their vehicles are. And we're just trying to pick out spots. And we're all, like all four of us in the aircraft are like, hey, what about there? What about there? No, I don't really like that. Well, what if we turn sideways and it's more of a cross thing, or 45 degrees on it, and it's kind of a complex slope, so that's not too much in either direction. And I'm like, well, no, that I'm looking at this waterline thing, and I'm like, that's probably more of a cliff than a slope. You know, you don't really want to land there. And so we kind of just circle the people, keeping them out the front of the aircraft, and we're over the water and just kind of circle around them. And that's when we see the boat ramp. Almost immediately, we're all kind of like, that's the spot. We know that's cement. And so we know it's going to be at least the same slope the whole time. We're not going to have to worry about some sort of cliff where the water's been for, you know, decades and just eroding away the ground. And there was, on that boat ramp, there was a little bit of a wider spot about a third of the way down. So we're like, okay, that's where we're going to put the back of the aircraft, right there, because that gives us the most rotor clearance from the trees and anything else. And it just so happened that that boat ramp was, or the launch ramp was, you know, kind of in the right spot. It was far enough away from the people that we weren't going to like blow them around with our rotor wash. We weren't going to cause any extra hazard to them. But at the same time, wasn't so far away that anybody who was injured was going to take an excessive amount of time to get to the aircraft. So we brief it real quick, and we set up for the landing. The guys in the back are doing their job exactly like they're supposed to. They're saying, hey, this is going to be an upslope landing, you know, upslope gear, your forward gear. And just like we've trained in our mountain training area, right? And so all that training kind of came back as muscle memory. And as we're assessing it on doing the low recon on the short final, you're like, hey, this is probably going to become a brownout landing, just because of the amount of dust in the sand that's on the beach, right? And the F model Chinook is awesome, because at the flick of a button, I have one button on the thrust, or the collective, we call it a thrust. And one button on there, I move it down, left, and up, and I can let go, and the aircraft will come to a hover and just hold it. It's all through the IMUs, you know, inertial altitude hold and inertial rate. They figure it all out, and they keep you in one spot, you know. And so what ends up happening is we just do this normal approach. We have all these modes armed and ready to go. The altitude hold is armed, but it's disengaged when we have the trigger on the collective pulled, because that's how we tell it, no, I want to move. I want to move something. And so it's just kind of standing by in the background. And then sure enough, as soon as that dust hits the forward cabin, the guys are calling it there. Hey, dust is forming. Dust is mid cabin. Dust is coming up to the forward cabin. That's when we transition inside, and our MFD has a, at 30 knots, it switches from a normal HSD or compass card, you know, or HSI basically.
Okay.
It changes from that to a hover display, where we have a vector, like a velocity vector that's shooting out, and just a compass tape. And so we can see our velocity vector, we can see our bank angles and all this other stuff. And it really helps with hovering. So we transition inside, I let go of basically everything. The aircraft starts coming to, it starts to slow down on its own, comes to a hover. The symbology kind of changes when it's all, we call it all locked up, when all three axes are locked up. And symbology changes, like, hey, we're all locked up. And that's when the guys in the back start going to work. I can't see anything up front. The guys in the back are like, okay, I need you to come forward 10 and left 3. And so to start, you know, pushing forward a little bit, get that velocity vector to move a little bit, and they call it down to zero. And when it's at zero, it's when we're over the spot, and they're like, all right, you clear down.
Jeez. With this, like, you, again, like, you guys are approaching over the water into the boat ramp, right? Boat ramp, concrete, or boat launch, I should say. And the plan, obviously, you're touching down on all your wheels. It's not like hovering back gate, back ramps open, right?
Oh, yeah, it's not like a two-wheel landing.
Okay, yeah, so touching down, but still, like, not seeing anything, going in there. What kind of, like, even space do you need for a Chinook, like, in my mind, I'm worried about like the random like pier pole or whatever that, you know, is sticking out there. Like, how much space do you need to put that Chinook down?
So the rotor is, I mean, we're basically 100 feet long and 60 feet wide, right? And that's from rotor tip to rotor tip. So a little bit more than that. And what's funny is that a lot of times we'll look at LZs and I'm like, nah, that's too, we're like, nah, that's too small. But once you get in there, it's huge. Like, you don't, like that apparent foreshortening that illusion makes you think it's too small, and you get in there and it's perfectly fine. And
something about having these like blades of death over your head, at least in my mind, that I'm like, nah, I need a football field at least.
So we get over that, and we had planned to do a four-wheel landing, and like any boat launch, I mean, it's a slope, it's a pretty significant one. Every year you've got vehicles that, you know, you get trucks over there that they get their tires wet and they can't get out of it, right? And so the biggest concern there is on the aft rotor, those rotors are 30 feet in the air, right? So from ground, you could have obstacles 15, and they're not going to hit the rotors because they just don't go that high, right? But the forward rotors, those are a lot lower to the ground. In fact, at the 12 o'clock of the aircraft, just sitting on a level surface, those rotors could come down to 4 feet, 4 inches. So yeah. So whenever, because the transmissions are tilted, that way we could ground taxi.
Okay.
And so like, don't ever approach a Chinook from the 12 o'clock, you know, and which is really weird because a lot of other aircraft, they want you to approach from the 12 o'clock. But so anytime somebody approaches from the 12 o'clock on us, when we're on the ground, our flanger usually tries to go and tackles them before they get there, you know, because that'll be a bad day for everybody for sure.
Yeah. Duly noted. 4 feet, four inches.
So if you're taller than 4 feet, 4 inches, it's going to be a bad day.
Well, this concludes part one of episode 16 with Chief Warrant Officer Joe Rosamond. You can hear the remainder of the story and the rescue in part two, which is available right now.